So this is our second day of this retreat on the path of altruistic living. I am here for you, right? And as was said yesterday, the path that most people in the world walk in this life is, you are here for me. Is that clear? If most people were honest, that is what is up on their wall. This was done by Thich Nhat Hanh. He didn't do that one. Because he understands and has always cultivated altruistic thoughts, altruistic aspiration, altruistic intention. But most of us from early childhood have been cultivating, you are here for me. And as was said yesterday, we need to see, not that that is immoral or unethical or wrong, but it is a path of suffering. It is a path that brings a suffering to ourselves, and it is a path that brings suffering to others. If you wonder why your life has not been happy, if you wonder why you have not been able to bring happiness to others, it is usually because at some level, we have lived a life that is focused on me. Is that clear? And we will talk about that today. I feel a deep sadness when I contemplate love and compassion. Is this self-absorption, and how can I shift to joy? Yes, it is self-absorption. I'm going to be very clear to you. It is self-absorption, and we will talk about the difference between empathy and compassion. This is not, if you have love and compassion, you don't have a chronic sadness. You have chronic sadness when you are stuck in empathy, and we will talk about that today. We think too much. Again, I think if the person who wrote this had listened to the teachings they've already received about love and compassion, they would not feel sadness. Are not suffering and compassion dualities? No. But in our minds, this is the problem with the thinking mind. It will invent endless problems for you. Is that clear? You know, we come here to practice what? To learn how to love, to learn how to be compassionate, to learn how to be open, and hear somebody going, well, isn't suffering and compassion, aren't these dualities? Now, is that a question that will free you from suffering? No, it'll just keep you ensnared more and more in your thoughts, in your analysis. We have to understand that is our chronic thinking. Going over, ruminating, mulling, try to figure it out. Is this like this and this like that and this? It is preventing us from being free. Right? Why can we not just follow the instructions? You have to ask ourselves that. What is it in me that I can't follow the instruction? I always question, endlessly question, isn't it like this, isn't it like that? Is that clear? I mean, I could, you know, spend time answering this question, but that wouldn't be helpful. Because the mind that is asking this question is the mind that is causing the suffering and the confusion. And you know what? As soon as it gets the answer to this one, it will generate another question. I don't even know who this person is, but I know that. This is a long line of questions, always having a question. And you wonder why you're not happy. You wonder why you don't have an open, loving heart. Isn't that what this is about? If you want to get answers to your intellectual questions, take an academic course on Buddhism. right? There's nothing wrong with that. And you will have somebody up in front of the room who will answer that in a very intellectual way. Well, the Buddha said, I teach one thing, the cessation of suffering. He said that so clearly, over and over again. When the Bellmaster says, free of the superiority, inferiority, equality complex, what does the equality complex mean? People die and fight for... I wonder if this is the same person. I think it is. Maybe not. Okay. So yes, that is. I'll back off on this one a little because most people haven't heard, and they say, "Well, don't people fight and die for equality?" This is not that equality. This is not political. This is not equal justice and things like that. This is about, and we've already begun that talking about a little bit. This is not the focus of this retreat, but in Buddhism, it is this self, and it's this belief in your separate self. And the stance that self is always taking in life, in terms of life and situations, that is the problem. Now, self, ego, self, takes different stances in life, right? Some people think what? I am better than everybody. I'm entitled, you know. I'm smarter, more handsome, more beautiful. I'm, you know, better than, deserve more, right? That's one stance of ego. Some people, for whatever their cause and conditions, prefer the opposite, right? I'm less than, I'm deficient, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. Right? That's another stance of ego that people get stuck in, right? Identify with. Some people identify themselves as great, some people identify themselves as less than. From the point of view of functioning emotionality, one might say those two stances produce different levels of emotionality and relation to life. But from the point of view of self, they're both identifications and are not true. You are more than you identify yourself as. Is that clear? Equality complex is that one that goes, well, I'm equal to everybody. Right? Why should that person be first online? I'm as good as them. Why did that person get the raise? I'm as good as them. Right? You see, it's that more subtle kind of it's kind of a jealous, envious thing, and it's a thinking. It's not acknowledging that some people get to the line first. That some people do get the raise, that some people are smarter than other people, that some people are better athletically, that some people are more beautiful. And you know what I mean? That's just the way it is, isn't it? There is difference in this world. We are different. Right? And that's okay too. Right? Is that clear? Squirrels don't run around going, hey, how come the dogs are the one that get to be taken in the house? I mean, aren't I a mammal too? Right? You know? They don't get around and talk that way. I'm equal to those. Right? You see? We laugh, but check your mind out and see whether you don't go there. Always comparing, always, you know, it's always about me. I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm equal to, I should. But at the end of the day, can you see, they're all about the same thing, which is what? Me. And that's the source of our suffering. In the five remembrances, we say, I am the nature to get sick. In the other meditation, we say, may I be healthy. Are they not contradictory? No. Use common sense, right? Would we like everybody in this world to be happy? Yes. Would we like everybody in this world to be healthy? Yes. Right? So therefore, we put our energy into trying to support that. On the other hand, do we understand that sickness happens? Right. Yes. So at the same time, it is our aspiration to nurture well-being and health in other people. We also understand that sickness is also part of life. Is that clear? They're not contradictory. Yes, I would love everybody to be happy. That's a good aspiration. That fuels a lot of positive energy. On the other hand, do I understand that there are many people who aren't happy? Of course. That's why I have the aspiration. Right? That's why I have the aspiration. The aspiration motivates us, motivates our minds, motivates our actions, motivates our speech. So we are always supporting the positive in life. Right? I was out to dinner last night at a Chinese restaurant. You know, good waiter. And when I'm leaving, what do I see? He's around the corner smoking. You know what I said to him? We had a friendly conversation. I said, you know, brother, and I'm sure you've heard this before, smoking is not good for you. And he said, I know, as he took another puff. I could have let it go, but I wanted to let him know that I cared about him. Because I did care about him. He's my brother, and he's doing something that's harmful to him. I didn't lay a heavy trip on him. I didn't give him a pamphlet. I knew he knew, but I just wanted to let him know that, you know, I wish that he would be healthy and that he wouldn't do things that were injurious to him. Right? This is about, let's hold this one. Oh, this is this person thinking. Okay, they want to influence as grandparents their grandchildren's altruistic mind. First retreat, how can I repair the cracks I think she means, or he means, my foundation, repair the cracks in their foundation, and begin to truly cultivate altruism. And what can you do when you've extended loving kindness to someone who is not receptive to it? Perhaps they do not trust your intentions. Could be. We'll talk about all these today. Again, it is important that we understand an altruistic world begins with an altruistic person. If I want an altruistic world, if I want altruistic grandchildren, if I want altruistic children, then the first person that I need to transform and to be altruistic is me. And then to make sure in all my actions of body, speech, and mind with this other person, my children, my grandchildren, the world, the waiters in a Chinese restaurant, that I am manifesting that. Begin there. See, right away we like to jump over me. See, I want to fix everybody else. How can I help them be altruistic? Well, why don't you become altruistic? Maybe when you figure out how you can transform your mind into a loving, compassionate, selfless mind, you will not be asking me that question. Is that clear? You'll have your own answer because you'll have done it yourself. You'll know it from the inside. And that's the best way to know. Okay. This is not magic. This is not mystical. Okay? This is very simple and practical. If you want to be an altruistic person, there is a path to it. Right? And all you got to do is walk that path. And when you have that loving, compassionate, altruistic mind, and you also have cultivated mindfulness and understanding and insight, you don't need to ask me. You will know. And if you've been spending your life always asking others, you've got to stop it. And begin to practice what you've already been told, what you've already learned, and start cultivating your own wisdom. Wisdom comes from experience. Experience comes from practice, from discipline, from doing. Everybody in here has that capability. Yeah, I mean, if they don't trust your intentions, there's obviously you generate loving kindness, but they don't trust your intentions. Could be. I mean, that's an effect of something from the past. Right? You can tell them that you have changed, that you mean well, but they might not trust you, because perhaps in the past you haven't. But then you just stay with it. Over time, they may see that you really have changed, that you are sincere. Okay? But again, we'll talk about this stuff. Again, everybody wants in the applications. Can you see it? See, it's all like, well, what do I do here? We haven't even learned how to do it yet. And already we want to know, well, how do I do it here? How do I do it there? See, that's this crazy mind of ours. Right? It's like, give me the answer. No, do it. And you'll see the answer. And if you make a mistake, you'll learn. Right? What works and what doesn't work. That's your own knowing then. How do I know for certain what I believe to be an open heart is truly devoid of ego? See, this is the nonsense. Listen to this one. You talk of altruism, the path to our own happiness. Is this not a form of selfishness? I mean, what is behind this question? What is behind this question? Anybody have an idea? What is behind this question? Yes. As opposed to what? I mean, so if the answer is yes, then what is this person going to do?
Make other people happy.
Yeah. Well, how can you make other people happy if you're miserable? I mean, how can you make other people happy if you're miserable? You see, it's like we skip over the essential. No happiness yourself. You know, people in this world, they're always talking about what? I need love. Have you ever heard that? I need love. I want somebody to love me. I need love. They never think, maybe the answer is, I need to become a loving person. Well, that's an interesting thought. Maybe love is already here. The potential is in you. Love is something to awaken within you. Can you see? If we always need love from the outside, we're basically saying, what's going on in here? It's empty. It's empty in here. And we know love is the most nurturing of foods, isn't it? And so we are always running around the world trying to get it, rather than realizing it's here already. I just have to open up that channel. I need to learn how to become a loving person. It's like when I used to do family therapy, a couples therapy, it'd be like, you know, I'd say to people, you know, any idiot can fall in love. Right? I mean, 13-year-olds fall in love. 18-year-olds fall in love. You know, nowadays, 80-year-olds still fall in love. Right? Rich people, poor people, educated, it doesn't matter. Anybody can fall in love. Creating a loving relationship. Now, that's something else, isn't it? Yeah. learning how to love, learning how to be a loving person, learning how to fill your own heart with love, with altruism. You see, that you have control over. Whether everybody in the world loves you, you don't have control over, do you? So this is a rather complicated question. Let me jump into these things. We have more questions here, and they're good questions, but we'll deal with them later or tomorrow. Good. So you've had some practice. You've been practicing connection and interconnection. You've been practicing remembering the kindness of benefactors. You have been learning that you can generate loving kindness to people. Is that true? Have you had a good time? Yeah. It's nice generating love. It's nice having good thoughts. As I said yesterday, this practice is about the transformation of this mind. This mind is, at this point, controlled by a conditioned stream of consciousness. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories that just arise of their own. If we want to change, we have to go about our transformation in a very conscious, clear, deliberate way, which is no different than for any other thing we want to learn in this life. Right? Any competency, any skill, anything at all, there has to be this focus, there has to be this consistency, there has to be this repetition, there has to be this motivation and commitment, right? We all know that. Everybody in here in some area of life has done that. This is no different. But it is even more important. Because you have a gift to have all the worldly success, in terms of using your energy, using your discipline, using your, I tough through this, right? And yet what? You may not be happy. You may not be open-hearted. You may not be at ease in life. This produces that. So this is even, I would say, more important. As was said yesterday, this is about being, not doing. I understand everybody in here is doing things all throughout the day. Right? Wonderful. Glad you're very busy doing. But what Dharma asks of us is, that person that is doing all this, how is she or he? Right? That's the question. If your goal is productivity, then you're on the right path. If your goal is happiness and well-being and open-heartedness and ease, you're on the wrong path. So again, it is very clear that each of us has to go like we said yesterday, what path am I on in this life? Am I on the worldly path? Then keep it up. I'm sure you could do more. I'm sure you could even extend your to-do list, right, and get more done. And if you're having trouble with it, I'm sure there are plenty of books and workshops and self-improvement tapes that you could listen to that would help you become more productive, right? Is that clear? This is not about that. Even though there are people these days trying to market mindfulness as a gain to productivity. That's how sick this world is. Right. Taking something that's about being and turn it into something about doing. Right. So again, please think. This person who I am, who is doing all these things throughout the day, how really is he or she? How is my mind? How is my heart? Is it open? Is it loving? Is it kind? Is it always thinking of others? Is it present to wherever I am? Or am I just like a, what was that one, Mr. Clean? What was that guy? Just kind of zipped around, getting everything clean. No, who was that one? Was that guy? What, Mr. Clean or something, or the Green Giant or something. Like right, I mean, right, Mr. Clean, right? He'd come into the kitchen and zoom, 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 right? Right, right. So I mean, again, nobody ever asked Mr. Clean, are you happy, Mr. Clean? I mean, I realize you're getting all the kitchens done, but are you really happy? I mean, I don't know. That would be, maybe he was. Maybe for him it was all about productivity, and he, you know, when he saw the clean kitchen, it made him happy. But that's a worldly happiness, right? Because if the kitchen wasn't clean, how would he feel? Unhappy. His happiness was conditioned on clean kitchens, not a very deep kind of happiness. So we have altruism and we have selfishness, right? As two polarities. And on that there is a continuum, right? We begin in life, it's interesting, we actually begin in life very open and relaxed. As infants and children, young children. Right? Even though there is emotionality and dependency, there is something very open and loving about a young child, isn't it? In that fresh mind. And yet, with the development of self, with the development of the I, me, my, more and more that open, spontaneous naturalness gets modified. And we leave that and we enter the world of self and self-identity. The world of I, me, my toys, my clothes, my name. This is mine, that's yours. And what started out then becomes very much a narcissist. Right? The child is centered totally on him or herself. And yet there is empathy. Right? Oftentimes when they see another child or their parents sad, they get sad. They come, you know what I mean? So it is there. There is a natural, there is at the base of the mind, there is this connection and interconnection that is really the way things are, right? And we might say that the child's mind is very much without boundaries and very connected to all that's around them. But over time, that world begins to narrow and more our minds become enveloped in the world of self and what's happening to me, and more we see life through the world of self. Myself. Fred's self. Right? And as the years go on, it gets more and more reified, becomes more of a solid thing, and it has a certain kind of cast or disposition because of the causes and conditions that have created it. But the problem is that we totally identify with it. And as the decades go by, it is a stronger and stronger identification. And we don't even realize. It's like having colored glasses. It's like having an astigmatism. We think that's the way things really are. But they're not. But we don't know that. And so this self that has lost its connection and its interconnection with all beings, with all life, no longer feels that sense of ease and comfort and trust and relaxation and openness of the young child, that curiosity. Right? Children are curious. Children are kind of fearless. That's why parents are scared. Children just jump into anything. They're fearless. They're curious. They want to touch everything. They want to put it in their mouth. They want to, you know, they see it, they want to do it. They don't have a lot of self. And there are some negatives in that. But and so more and more, by the time our self is developed, because intrinsically this self has lost its deeper connection to life, to its true self, as an experience, as a feeling, as a sense of just deep groundedness and well-being within itself, it is always seeking outside itself. Right? It is always trying to establish itself by getting something, by proving something, by identifying with something. Is that clear? Because it fundamentally is not real, it always has to say it's real. And it's endlessly grasping at this and liking this and dislike. You know, by the time you get to be an adult, you have a million likes and dislikes. You have an opinion on everything, don't you? And that's who you think you are. Many people say to me, you know, they hear the verses, have you been chanting verses, trust in mine, you know. Wow, if I gave up all my dislikes and all my preferences, who would I be? Well, I think that's a good question. Yeah. It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because it first says, I think who I am is all my likes and dislikes and all my opinions and beliefs. And if I didn't have them, who would I be? Well, in Buddhism, that's the wisdom path. Who would I be? You know, who is it who has all these opinions and likes and dislikes? Who's that? See, it's a very different question. Who's that? If I didn't have my identity as a good person, a bad person, if I didn't have my identity that I'm better than or worse than, if I gave up my belief that I'm damaged, if I gave up my belief that I'm wonderful, who would I be? Who would I be? Be. Remember be? Being. Who am I really? So, the egoist at its worst is entering into life with only one agenda. What's in it for me? When they're in relationship, the other person is there to what? What? To meet my needs, to make me happy, to end my suffering. And whenever that is not occurring, there's what? An argument, a conflict, anger, resentment. Or else you go, it's time to find a new one. Right? You know, they're only good for 2 or 3 years before they're going to run out of capacity to really meet my needs. So then right? That's the way the ego thinks. It's always about me. Everything's about me. How can this situation, how can it feed my need to feel special? How can this person, how can this situation feed my need to feel like I'm a somebody, to feel that I'm likable, smart, right? See, every situation is always about me. Every person, how can they meet my needs? Body needs, physical needs, mental needs, ego needs. That's the world of self. Now, So some of that is very obvious to us, right? But a lot of it, the world of self, is more subtle, right? So when, you know, so a lot of people talk about, well, don't like vulnerability, do I? Don't like vulnerability, do I? No. Don't like to feel insecure, unsafe. Keeping the wall up. That's what's most important in life, right? Well, who are you protecting? Who are you keeping safe? Who? Me. It's a me you can't see. It's not your body. Who are you keeping safe? Who's scared of being vulnerable, being seen? Me. Well, what is that, me? It's some identity I have of who I am and what I can do and what I can't do. Right? So you can see it's really about me. Anxiety. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if this happens? But the anxiety and the fear is all about what's going to happen to who? Me. And I could go through everyone, you know? Who's angry? Ever get angry, Kelly? Why do you get angry? People don't give me what I want. I mean, thank you. That was simple. Yeah. I mean, that's it. You know, somebody's not giving me what I want. What I want. When you hear the word I, me, mind, you know self is present. Okay. So, I mean, self, you know, you can be altruistic. In other words, you could act altruistically, and yet inside you're going, what? It's in, you know, want to look good, want to look altruistic. Feeds my ego, right? Or maybe, you know, if I appear this way, people will like me, or people will think, you know, oh. So self can insinuate itself even in your altruism. So it's not always either or. They get mixed, right? So even a lot of our good stuff is about me. Me, 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 me. Now, I bring up this subject not to bring you down, but to understand that the path to altruism has to recognize, and you will run into, and you may have run already into it in the last 24 hours. You may notice that the more you erect in your mind an altar to love and compassion and altruism and connection and thinking of others, right? The first thing you may notice how little of that you actually do. Does that make sense? That's good, you see. Practice and these teachings are also mirrors. They are lights. They turn on the light. And we want to come out of the dark. Most of us are in darkness about our minds and ourselves and how pervasive and pernicious I, me, mine permeate every aspect of our life. Is that clear? Watch it. So, absolute narcissistic, movement at this polarity over here is a bodhisattva. In Buddhism, we talk about bodhisattva. This enlightened being whose mind only has positive thoughts, loving thoughts, compassionate thoughts, thoughts for the well-being of others. Right? That's all that's going on, as well as there's a whole repertoire of positive emotions. Altruism, the altruistic mind. Now, as I said yesterday, and I'll say it again, please understand that this is an unhappy mind, no matter how it looks. Is that clear? It is an unhappy mind, no matter how good on the outside it looks. Selfishness does not produce happiness. Anger, fear, jealousy, envy, sadness does not produce happiness or well-being. It cannot. These are afflictive mind states. Self-centeredness produces loneliness. We feel very alone. I find loneliness a very interesting subject. Many people are lonely. And they think they're lonely because there's nobody home with them, right? If I only had somebody home with me. But yet, if there's anybody here who's ever been lonely at home when they're alone, have you ever been at home alone and not felt lonely? I mean, sometimes it's nice to be alone, isn't it? Ooh, thank God no one's here. I have the place to myself. This is great. Right? So, loneliness is not about whether anybody's in the house with you. Is it? No. Right? People think, oh, loneliness is because I don't have the right relationship. Right? Well, have you ever had the right relationship and wanted to get out of it? Oh, well, that's interesting. Again, loneliness is the way the self is looking at a situation and telling us what? Something is missing. The self, because it does not exist, this is very important to understand psychologically, because inherently there's no such real thing as a self and it doesn't exist, the only way it can show it exists is by doing something. This is why people, depending where they are on the scale of self-absorption, right, find it more and more difficult to be alone with themselves. It's not comfortable to be alone. Right? For many people, most people perhaps, when they are alone, it doesn't feel good. Is that clear? Anybody have a dog? Yeah. Ari's, you think when Ari's home alone, he's not feeling good?
He misses me.
No, you... Yeah, you wish. No. When Ari's home alone, how is he? He's fine. You know, he's happy. He's happy when you're home, but he's also happy when you're not home. Why is that? Because as soon as you come in, he's happy. He's, right? Yeah, well, that's interesting. That shows you that is our natural state, the sense of well-being and ease. Right? We can be alone. It can be with others. Again, I'm not making a case for staying alone. We are social animals. I'm not, you don't understand, but we have to understand that this chronic neediness is coming from a self that always has to be real. You know, I need, for me to exist, I need to see you see me. Right? If I can't see somebody else sees me, then I don't exist. And for most egos, that is the worst thing to experience. It happens to be the truth that we really inherently don't exist. But ego is keeping up the game. I exist. I'm important. I'm the center of your universe, Fred. No, that's what mine says. Yours says something else. It has your name on it.
Right.
Right? You know, I have to be noticed. Feed me. How does an ego get fed? By having opinions, by having likes and dislikes. I like this and I don't like that. I think this and I don't think that. This is right, this is wrong. Hey! I'm wonderful. Right? And then we become cheerleaders for our children to convince them that they're wonderful. You know, there was some study that said like 30 years ago when you asked most children, I don't know, are you important? You know, maybe 20% said. Now like 80% said. It's because of the education. You know, I mean, everybody gets a trophy. From a certain point of view, that makes sense. But another point of view, it's like, what is that really feeding? Right? I mean, a lot of kids these days, their aspiration is to be what? What? Famous. Be a celebrity. Be a rock star. Right? Not to play rock and roll, but to be a rock star. I mean, that's, you know, everybody feeds on applause. To be noticed, to be the center of the universe. The ego wants to be, the ego goes to a party, and if nobody doesn't pay any attention to them, how do they feel? What? Bad.
Invisible.
But the invisibility is not the body. The invisibility is this thing inside that's going, hey, people, somebody special has just shown up. Right? I mean, can't they all see that somebody special has just walked into the room and is really deserving of being the center of attraction? Isn't that how that little voice speaks to you? It's not just me, is it? No. That's the voice. It may have its own language. But that's what it's always telling us. That's why praise and blame. Buddhism, we say, you know, get beyond praise and blame. Self wants praise, doesn't like what? Blame. Ooh, don't criticize me. Right? The idea that somehow I would be wrong or make a mistake or be at fault, I mean, that's unbelievable. Self always likes success. How does a self like failure? What? Mm-mm-mm. Not for me, right, Rob? Mm-mm-mm. Not for this self. Only success, failure. Right? Is that clear? Pleasure, yes. Pain, no. Success, yes. Failure, no. Center of attraction, yes. Anonymous, no. Endlessly like that. And you wonder why you're not happy, why your mind is agitated, why there's always emotionality up and down going on. Can you see the operating principle? Okay. On the other side, the I am here for you side. What if all that, what I've been belaboring for the last 20 or 30 minutes. What if that wasn't there? Now, I'm talking about inside your mind, that voice, all that activity, and all the emotionality that is generated. I mean, I belabored it. Does everybody understand what I'm talking about? What if you could imagine that was not there in your mind at all? Just close your eyes and just imagine. Imagination, remember, we're children. Children imagine anything. I go to my grandson, you know, one day he's a rabbit. Next day he's a train. It's like, you know, the world of imagination. He can be, you know, imagination. Imagine for the moment that self voice, that self concern, that's always defending, attacking, advancing, retreating, liking, disliking, hurt, angry, scared. What if that wasn't there? It's just a voice that creates emotions, creates actions. What if there was silence there? Just start with that. What if there was just silence? Or just a nice, pleasant hum? What if there was nobody always generating opinions, likes, dislikes, always wanting to be noticed, always this, always that? Drove in traffic, wasn't always, I can't believe this person did this or that, or did that. That jerk and that idiot. People licenses like that. Can read politics and not get into their soapbox. How would that be if there was silence there? Or there was an absence of that? All of that. And everybody here knows what I'm talking about. What would that be like? Anybody want to just, in this world of imagination, imagine what that'd be like? Yes. There would be equanimity. Equanimity means kind of balance, not up, not down. No. More equanimity in life. Anything else? Yes.
24 hours ago, I could not have imagined this, but what I saw was a big smile and everything possible. And
happiness, big smile, and all of a sudden, in the moment, in experience, yeah, could go this way, could go that way, no longer bound by fears and self-identities and what I can do and what I can't do and what I like and what I dislike and who I am and who I'm not, right? This is who I am. And that's where the ego talks. This is who I am. Nobody talks to me like that. Why not? Nobody treats me this way. Why not? Right, other people get treated this way. Why shouldn't I get treated this way? Right? Can you see the ego? It's like, I'm exceptional. Good.
Yeah. Celebrity say, do you know who I am?
Right. What do you say?
No, I'm a celebrity.
No, I want to know what you say. What do you say?
I don't think you know who I am.
Good.
I'm unknown.
Which is what? So what if you didn't have that? Yeah. See, what if that whole, and you understand that it at its core, when you get down deep and you see, oh, it's just a set of beliefs about myself, right? But yet you see, wow, it's sort of like what you just said. It's sort of like, wow, if I'd never had that voice telling me this, or this identifying of who I am and who I'm not, what could have my life been like? You see? It's like that, Sandy. Because it's like, and what Buddhism says is, it is that easy. Because it is, you know, that person who thinks she's less than is not real. It's just thoughts about herself. That's been built over time, so it kind of, it's gotten thicker, you see? You know what I'm saying? But that's all. When you look at it, you see there's nothing there. So, yeah. Yeah. I know. But I would go even further and say, so what if I have bad hair? You see what I'm saying? It's because to you know, in the 60s, 70s or 80s, some of the affirmations were big. People remember affirmations. Everybody was doing affirmations, right? Remember that? I'm wonderful. I can do anything. Look in the mirror. I love you. Look at yourself. I love you. You're one. I mean, I was like, I mean, that kind of garbage was being passed around. Right? It's just trying to recreate the self rather than going, oh yeah, So what if I have bad hair? That doesn't make me a bad person. Right? You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's because we identify with these things. That's why I would say, yeah, so what, you know, yeah, I have screwed up. I mean, I used to see people in therapy, they come and say, I'm the world's worst mother. I mean, I just screwed up my kids terribly. And I said, you probably have. But what do you want to do today? You know, how do you want to be today? Right? You know. So you've had bad hair for your whole life. I mean, that's not the worst crime, is it? I mean, there are people in this world who've done worse. I mean, oftentimes we have to laugh at ourselves, Sandy, for how we've gotten ensnared in things. When we step back with some wisdom, we go, it's hair, right? You know, in 2 minutes you could shave it all off, then no more bad hair. Well, eliminated that problem. Good. You never thought of that as a solution, did you? Ever imagining that space, yes.
It seems to me that it would be like this beautiful clarity.
Yes.
You'd be looking out, and all of a sudden you could really see what was right in front of you.
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right. It's like we don't realize how much energy is involved in self-absorption, right? We're going through our life, we're going through our day, we're interacting, but the inner focus is always on me and how I'm doing and what I'm feeling, and, you know. And you're right. So we may appear that we're in the world, but 75% of us could be all tied up inwardly. You're absolutely right. So there's a lot of energy that's freed up and a lot of clarity that comes because now we're not seeing life through this filter of self and all its neurotic back and forth. Exactly. Yeah, so it's actually like that. I'm glad you can imagine it. That's a beginning. Now, to understand that this egocentric, neurotic, emotionally labile mind of ours is just really a bundle of thoughts, feelings, and perceptions that have been reified over time. That's all it is. With a spiritual path, we are now fortunate enough to find out there is another path in life. Okay? There's just another way to be. And that one can now look at this whole morass of egocentric, self-centered living, and again, everybody has their own variation. For some, it's been more painful than others. For more, it's been all encapsulating than others. But still, it's the predominant for all of us to one degree or another. And all of a sudden, we are presented with another way of being. I am here for you. Oh, when I get up in the morning. That's what this day is about. It's not about all the things that I need to do for me. It's about how can I spend this day bringing benefit to others. Try that one out. Right? Rather than a day of all the things that I got to do, I want to do this. I was talking to somebody last week who was saying, oh, I got a lot of resistance to going here and doing this, you know. Part of me just wants to stay home and do this and that. And I asked him, well, what are these things you got to do? Well, they sound like all decent things. He said, well, you know, sounds like you're only thinking of yourself. Right? Sounds like going out and doing these things will bring benefit to others. Staying home will only bring benefit to who? to you. Right? We need to look at our choices in life and how often they're really just all about me. What will bring benefit to me today? What do I want to do today? Can you see it? We all know that one, right? What do I want to do today? If that's the path of happiness. You know, people are very much into these days, I need privacy. Right? I need alone time. What do they do when they call alone time? Take a guess. Anybody here ever, you know, want alone time? What do? Watch TV.
Eat junk food.
Eat junk food.
Crossword puzzles.
Facebook, surf the internet, that's called alone time. I don't call that alone time. You're spending time with the boob tube. I need some good time, good quality time with the boob tube. That's what I need today. You know, I mean, that's how crazy we are. Right? Rather than doing something really meaningful or nurturing, and the truth is, we need, when we say, you know, we need downtime, I need alone time, I need to be with myself. Now, again, if that really meant what we said, that I really want some contemplative, reflective time to really nourish myself, to step back, really check in with, you know what I'm saying? I'm certainly in favor of things like that, but that's not usually what people are doing. I want to withdraw back into the shell of self, where I can just do what? What I like to do. Some private time for just me and Fred. How special. Isn't that the truth? And yet the truth is, and again, I'm exaggerating, I realize. But I'm also, I think, trying to make a point. The research is clear. Altruistic people are happier than selfish people. People who feel connected to others are happier and have more positive emotionality and less stress than people who feel disconnected and alone. Is that, you know, it was quite amazing to me. I've been teaching altruism and these meditations for 30, 40 years. And in preparation for this retreat, I kind of did a Google search. And it was really fascinating to me that there is a whole field now of research on altruism. I mean, it's quite wonderful. Study after study, altruism. And you know what they're using? They're using the same meditations that we do here. They're taking them from Buddhism. And all of a sudden, they are showing, you know, people who do metta meditation or exchange or, you know, equalizing, you know, kind of things you've learned, you know, 30 minutes a day for 3 weeks, you know, all these positive effects, right? And it's not only a positive effect in terms of having more connection to people, et cetera, the kind of things you think, but they're actually less stressed and talk about happier in their daily life, which is very interesting. It's showing that a lot of the, you know, because people are also researching on mindfulness, you know, and stuff like that. And they're showing that people who are cultivating a loving heart, an altruistic heart, a compassionate heart, are getting many of the same results as people who are just cultivating mindfulness by themselves. It's very interesting. So for those of you who like that kind of stuff and need that kind of stuff, it's, you know, I mean, research-based, evidence-based, it's there now. I mean, in the Buddhist tradition, it's been known for 2,600 years, but now, you know, there are postdocs and everything getting published by showing the same thing. But again, I found it really fascinating that they're clearly demonstrating that an altruistic mind, a loving mind, a mind that sees connection with other people is a happier human being, is a more content human being. It kind of has a generalizing effect to one's whole life. So understand that what you're doing here today and what you did yesterday, if you continue doing these practices, you will, it's researched and science has shown us, you will feel differently. Right. So let me stop for questions, comments. Anything not clear, if anyone want to challenge? I mean, people don't know me. I mean, I'm very happy if anybody wants to stand up for selfishness or rugged individualism. If there are any Ayn Rand aficionados who want to say, you know, the social good is only benefited by people who are totally self-interested and selfish, I'm open to anything. Yes.
Fred, you said you would draw a distinction between empathy and compassion. I'd love to hear what it is.
Yeah. It struck me, and again, I've always, I mean, in Buddhism, it is always said very clearly that empathy and sympathy is not in what Buddhism, again, these are, remember, we're taking concepts, we're taking bodies of teaching, and we're giving them one word, right? So when somebody translates from another language, such as Sanskrit, right? So in the Sanskrit, it's called karuna, right? Now that's translated into English as compassion, okay? And for many people, they think compassion, sympathy, pity, empathy are all sort of the same thing. In Buddhism, they're not, okay? Empathy, which is this capacity, let's say, to feel what somebody else is going through, empathic, is different from compassion, because compassion in Buddhism means it combines empathy. I mean, obviously, there has to be this sense of connection and a sense of empathic relationship that allows you to kind of feel or know or imagine what somebody else is going through in the realm of suffering. But it most importantly, it implies an immediate desire to be of benefit. This is very important. In Buddhism, compassion is active. Empathy is passive. And so when I was reading the research, I found something that really struck me. Anybody hear of compassion fatigue? That was big. I don't know if it still is. I mean, I spent my life in the mental health professional and the healing, and a number of years ago, that was a big one, right? Compassion fatigue is still big,
right?
And what this person said was, no, what people are having is empathy fatigue. It was very interesting. Because again, as someone who's practiced this, the emphasis always is on this desire to alleviate the suffering, which is active. And basically the point this person was making, I think very wisely, was that people they think being empathic is enough. So people are like empathic, but again, they're the passive recipient of the suffering of another. And they kind of get stuck in it. There's no resolution, right? I mean, it's sort of like if you were a nurse, or you know, if you were a nurse and you had a room full of sick people, right? And you really felt their illnesses, right? But you couldn't do anything. After a while, that could be what? Fatiguing, exhausting, depleting, right? But if, you know, you walk into the room, you see all the sick people and say, well, let's get cooking, right? Who's first? Then that's what? That's an expression of what?
Compassion.
Compassion, love, caring. Right? You see what I'm saying? It's like that. And that, I mean, it's not saying that if you just go on a 12-hour shift, you're not fatigued, you know, a normal fatigue. But it's not this, it's not, so I thought this was very wise, and this is my own experience. Have you done the alchemical exchange yet? Tonglen? You haven't done that. You will do that today. That's a very profound practice, which actually tells us how to be present to suffering, our own suffering and others, and just transform it. Okay? Because when the response, the empathy is that what you've already been working on, connection, right? You know, I feel connected to other people, right? I understand they're human beings like me. I've done that meditation, so I get out of my, it's just about me, right? I've done the, you know, equalizing meditation. You've done that. Very wonderful. You know, we at this point, we do not generate a wide loving kindness because we divide the world up, right? Those we like, and those we like what? They're certainly worthy of our loving kindness and compassion, aren't they? Definitely. Those we don't like, yuck. I don't care what happens to them. I mean, many people, when they hear something bad happens to somebody that they dislike or an enemy, they're happy, right? And then there's a majority of people that we're just indifferent to. So in this path of altruism, that's another thing that we want to break down, those walls between those three divisions. And, you know, and just generally be able to see all beings as the object for my love, for my understanding, for my compassion, for my empathy, right? I'm willing to put myself in the shoes of everyone. And when I put myself in the shoes of everyone, of those people that I'm neutral or indifferent to, and those people that I consider enemies, I can understand why they are the way they are, why they act the way they do. Right? Even if you have to arrest them, even if you have to, you don't have hatred. You don't have dislike. You can actually have love. Right? I mean, we know in our own country, anybody ever heard about Martin Luther King? Right? A great social activist and all that, and yet these are the principles that he worked on. You've all heard about loving thine enemy. The Buddha wasn't the only one who said. And so, So I don't believe that compassion is fatiguing. And as you will learn today, you need enough empathy so you can be really present to another's suffering. Is that clear? You can't be indifferent. You can't, you know, many people in the helping professionals, they get a wall. They've seen it so much. You need to always keep an opening that you never lose that. Right? That you see every day. If you're, when you're dealing with people who are suffering, you touch it. You let a little in. But that's just a little in, because your main thing is what? To give service, to be of help. So you let enough in so that your compassion stays alive. Your empathy stays alive. Is that clear? But you don't flood yourself. Many people, when they talk about it, it's really, they're just flooded because they're just, they're empathic for no good reason anymore. Right? I mean, how does it, you know, to, if someone is suffering, right? To be moved by their suffering is good. To want to help is even better. But if all you're stuck in and just ruminating and obsessing about the suffering of another person, how are you helping them? How are you helping them? Please answer me for those people who get stuck there. They worry about, oh, what happened this? Or they just go over and over. I can't, my, they go over and over. Their own suffering, their past suffering, other people's suffering, their children. How does that help them? Anybody who does that, answer me. And I'm sure there are many people in this room who do that. That's their modus operandi in life. And they think they're a compassionate person. You're not. You're an over-empathic person. Over. Sounds strong. I know it does. But it's true. We have to get real. You're not helping anybody. And it's often, you know, it's the other person suffering is causing you distress. It's you who's distressed because you don't know how to be present to another's suffering in a compassionate way. And we have to realize, again, it's just another self thing. Is that clear? I mean, this is, we have to change. I mean, all this stuff, you know, people think, oh, I'm such an empathic person. I feel everybody's suffering. So what? I mean, you know, let me just say it like that. So what? Are you helping anybody? If all you're doing is gnashing teeth about the suffering of the world and, oh, so the world's so much suffering, people so suffering, you know, my children are suffering, everybody's suffering. Oh, it breaks my heart, tears flowing all the time. Just you. That's all you're concerned about, you. You're in distress. Why don't you go help them? And if you can't help them, then go help somebody else who wants to be helped. Is that clear? You know that famous anecdote, you know, in Thich Nhat Hanh's life where he was, actually this guy became a Buddhist priest. He was a Vietnam vet, you know, the terrible story. I mean, he killed many people, children, you know, it's, I forget in what books it's talked about. But, and he'd come to Thai in those days, we used to now and then give retreats for veterans. And he just, you know, he came back to States, he, you know, alcoholism, addiction, I mean, the whole thing, you know, just because he always lived with this, you know, especially the children, you know, that kind of just ate at him. I mean, and at the retreat, you know, there was a lot of catharsis opening, but Thay's response to him was, you know, you cannot bring those children back. That's, you've done it. But if you are remorseful, right, if you are really remorseful, there are many children in this world who are suffering right now. Go help them. What? Go help them. Don't stay stuck. Don't stay stuck. Because that stuckness is our own self-absorption. And I know I'm speaking strongly, but it's really, you know, I'm a bad person. You know, people. Many people are stuck. I'm a bad person. I've done so many bad things. Get over it. Yeah, maybe you have been a bad person. How do you want to be today? I mean, isn't that the only issue? You know? I mean, when I used to work with people, I'd say to them, I don't know. I mean, you've been thinking you're a bad person for 20 years. How much longer do you want to keep it going? Another year? 2 years? I mean, you tell me. Right? Or would you want to chart a new course for yourself in this life? You know, what if you just stop today with all that? I'm a bad person. You've been working it for 20 years. Where's it gotten you? Miserable. You know, have you, you know, is that clear? I mean, we have to have this ability to have this self-awareness that we can see what's arising within us and see what's helpful and not helpful, what's functional and not functional, dysfunctional. What's wholesome, what's not wholesome, and make good choices. How do we want to be? Again, it doesn't mean the past doesn't exist. I mean, in a true sense, it does. But it means, you know, our habit energy and the way we've done stuff will still come up. But again, today, in this moment, you sit here and retreat? Has anything from your past, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, come up? Well, anybody? What do you do? That's the issue. When that happens, is there mindfulness? Is there awareness? And do you handle that arising skillfully? Do you know how to do it? Is that clear? You know? When you have a judgmental thought, do you know it? Do you immediately replace it with a positive thought about that person or situation? Immediately. That's basic behaviorism, right? Correct? Recorrect? Hit the wrong note? Stop, hit the right note. And for if you really want to learn it, hit the right note about a dozen times. Oh, right? Everybody know that? Simple. That's how you change the mind. There's a science to this. It's not going to happen by itself. Somebody wrote a question. People familiar with Zen? Somewhat familiar with Zen? Anyhow. You mentioned Zen. My limited understanding Zen practice leads to awakening to the true nature of reality. There is only one, no me, no you. Know it, all is one. That's my limited understanding. This then leads to caring for all sentient beings. Two sub-questions. First of all, I'd say to that person, is that true? First of all, have you met many people who have really had a full awakening, that they really have come to a profound transformation in their mind, like the Buddha, that there is absolutely no separation between them and anyone else? And they, just like the right hand cares for the left hand, it's just this complete sense of identification with all beings. I would say if somebody has had that kind of awakening, there's a good chance they're going to act good in the world. But an insight into is not the same. It's not transformative in that way. The Buddha had a great enlightenment. Some beings have had these kind of great transformative enlightenments. But even the Dalai Lama. Everybody know who the Dalai Lama is? Anybody not know who the Dalai Lama is? Right? Dalai Lama is considered an emanation, the 14th emanation, and he's the 14th Dalai Lama, and he's considered by the Tibetans to be an emanation of who? Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Doesn't get any better than that in the realm of compassion. Right? So in 1975, when I was studying Dharamsala, I was able to have a private interview with him. And at that point, I'd been practicing Zen. He was very clear to me about that this practice is a day-to-day practice. And you know what he said to me? He said, you know, I look back on my own practice over these last couple of years, and I can see I'm getting a little more selfless. A little more selfless. 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 Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Now, if the Dalai Lama can say that, certainly the Zen masters can. Again, on the wisdom side, if someone has had a true insight into the nature of reality, into the non-self nature of their self, have really seen that all thoughts, feelings, perceptions are inherently empty, it will make it much easier to act in the world in a selfless way. But the contaminations that have existed in the mind stream for decades, if not lifetimes, are quite pernicious, and they will continue, right? Certainly having a deep insight into your mind will be a great benefit. But still, this work has to be done. Again, you know, connect, is the connectivity we talked about a prelude to the oneness? Again, it is considered in the Mahayana Bodhisattva path, and now we're talking bigger than this retreat, but that in this path of transformation, we are cultivating two things. One is wisdom, one is altruism. And they work together. This cultivation of an altruistic path softens the self. Right? It gets the mind to think and relate to others as no different to me. As you're cultivating the wisdom time side, you will actually see that that is actually true. That you are me and I am you. And that when I take care of you, I take care of me. Because there is no me in you. That is why this whole sense of privacy and I need time and I get it is really ultimately about the self. Bodhisattvas are selfless. They spend all their time benefiting others. Because they don't distinguish between self and others. Right? We need what? We need some my time. Because when I'm with you, I don't see you as me. Is that clear? But when I begin to see that you are me, and that my time with you is my time, right? It's like that famous, you know, in the Miracle of Mindfulness, when Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, remember he's talking to this father, and he's a new father, and he's going on about, you know, he misses my time, because, you know, he has to, right? Has to be with his son, has to be with his wife, you know what I mean? It's like, always having to. And Thich Nhat Hanh says to him, well, what if you didn't see it that way? What if you thought, what if you labeled your time with your son as my time? What if you labeled your time with your wife as my time? Right? Get out of the self. You know, there's a famous line in Shantideva where he's trying to disabuse people of their self. And he says, look how crazy people are. He said, you know, again, this is Tibet, so he talks about horse traders. He said, right? He says, you know, you go to the horse trading show and all these horses and, you know, and then you're interested in that horse, right? If anything happened to that horse, all of a sudden it dropped dead or something, you wouldn't care. You go what? Whew, good thing I didn't buy that one. Right? You see what I mean? You wouldn't care. You wouldn't care if anybody's feeding the horse. You wouldn't care if anybody's taking care of it. Right? Why not? It's not my horse. Right? Now let's say you buy the horse. Right? Now it's your horse. It's my horse. Right? Now everything about the horse you're going to care about. Is that true? What's changed? It's the same horse. Right. The horse hasn't changed in 5 minutes. Its needs haven't changed. What's changed in the last 5 minutes?
Your relationship.
Yeah, it became mine. And once it became mine, then I care about it. Well, what if I went to that horse show thinking they're all my horses? See, it's a cognitive shift, too. Ultimately, it's more profound than that. Right? What if I saw everybody's suffering as my suffering? It's just a labeling. Right? I often use the example with people. I say, you know, our center's on Nebraska Avenue, right? I don't know if people know Tampa, Nebraska Avenue. A lot of suffering people walk up and down it. You know? And many people, you know, oh, look at that one and that one. They're prostitutes, they're druggies. Or, you know what I mean? Right. Homeless, you know what I mean? I mean, people who are... Right, but we're kind of indifferent or we're judgmental often. But what if all of a sudden you looked one day and you saw, oh my God, that's, you know, you look at that prostitute on the street, you know, that's somebody's, you know, that's, God, that's, you know, Nancy's daughter. Right? Or you look at somebody and go, wow, God, that's Jimmy from high school. Right? What would change? You start to care. Well, what's shifted? The person is still the same person they were 2 minutes ago, but all of a sudden you have what? I made a connection. Right? And when there's that connection, then our response changes. Right? I mean, I also use the example, you know, anybody ever read the obituaries? Who reads the obituaries? Okay, so you read the obituaries. Bump, you know, one to the other, bump, 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 right? Now, all these people have died, haven't they? Right? And all these people, somebody hopefully is suffering because of their loss. But we go bump, 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 bump. And all of a sudden we see somebody's name that we know. And then all of a sudden we go, oh, how terrible, they died. Isn't that true? Yeah. It's like we couldn't care about any of the others that we didn't know. But all of them have died. You know, people are suffering, who are missing. So that's, again, I mean, that's human, you know what I'm saying? But it's to understand. We need to understand that so much of this is just because, you know, and you don't have to wait to full enlightenment to feel connectivity. It is cognitive as well as emotional. It is the way we view things. Right? All beings are my mother. Anybody ever hear that one? Wow. When you think that way, just you think that way, you establish the reason they call them motherly sentient beings in the text is because they want us to see relationship to. Is that clear? So these practices are wonderful. So good. So today you'll be introducing Tonglen, profound practice. When I encountered Tonglen, I was like, oh, so this is how you do it. This is the transformation. This is how to transform the heart and the mind. Very directly, very simply. It's a wonderful practice. Metta's a rubber practice. Now again, if you do metta like an affirmation, you're not helping anybody. Okay. Many people think, oh, I'm a compassionate person. Oh, why? Well, I do metta meditation. I mean, people talk like that. No. It's with people we do. The practice is, right, is so we can change our minds and our hearts so we can practice with people. You know, in Zen, you take the vow. I vow to liberate all sentient beings. Anybody ever hear that? Yeah. Now, that sounds very grandiose, doesn't it? Or sounds impossible. And you can make it very abstract. Most people make it abstract. But one day it struck me. Oh, now I get it. If I've made the vow to help all sentient beings, this person in front of me is one of those. See, I made a connection. Oh, if I have, you know, that's why we do metta. That's why we generate loving kindness and say, may all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings know the joy, and all that. Now, why do we do that? So we can feel good about ourselves? No. So in all our encounters with everybody during the day, we remember, oh, this is one of those. Remember in my meditation? Right? May all beings be happy. That means everybody I encounter, I want to be happy. Is that clear? That's what it's about. It's not just an affirmation. Many people do it with it, you know, just like it's words. It's like we're trying to graft something healthy onto a tree that is unhealthy. Don't do that. Plant your love, plant your compassion, plant your sense of connection with beings deep in your heart and live it. all beings are my mother. If you don't like that one, all beings are your children. All beings are your first cousin. You know, whatever works for you. You know, if you don't like, if you didn't like your mother, and if you don't like your children, and if you don't like your first cousin, I don't know, all beings are my pet rat. If that's what you love. All right? Whatever works for you. But sense that connection, that caring. So we'll stop.